Good. That's fine. You are excused. We'll see you at noon. We are scheduled to have members of the Coalition of Wisconsin Aging Group's Senior Statesmanship Program. Anyone hear from that? Well, good. We welcome all of you here. And I think you're close enough to the bench that you can see our name tags. Do you want me to introduce the court, or is that adequate? Okay. On my far left is Justice Diane Sykes. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. Seated next to me on my left is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. Seated to my immediate right is Justice William Babbage. Seated to his right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And seated to the far right is Justice David Prosser. Justice Bradley will be meeting with the Baraboo High School mock trial team who saw leave the courtroom. Anyone who would like to join them for a discussion of the court procedure is welcome. In fact, we encourage you to stay. You'll enjoy not only Justice Bradley, but you'll enjoy the young students. I'll call the second case 00-1137 in the matter of the guardianship and protective placement of Goldie H. County of Dunn versus Goldie H. John Joyce representing Goldie H. Counsel, you may proceed.
Chief Justice and Justices of the Court, may it please the Court. My name is John Joyce, and I am the court-appointed guardian ad litem for Goldie H. I would like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
You have it, Counsel.
I think one of the issues that you need to look at first is the issue that was raised by the Court of Appeals as to whether or not Goldie H. was aggrieved and had standing to appeal. At the Court of Appeals level, I've cited the Auer case, which I think makes it clear that if a order directly injures the party's interest in an appreciable way, the party's aggrieved. In this case, there are issues...
The guardian ad litem?
Pardon?
You are the guardian.
I am, yes.
And you filed a petition for continuation, right?
I filed the petition with this court.
What about in the trial court?
In the trial court, there was a series of letters that went back and forth.
Okay.
One of them, I don't recall the dates, but I wrote to the court pointing out the lack of hearing and findings under the statute. Corporate counsel responded.
But the court did what you requested it do, namely not have a hearing, but enter the order. Is that correct?
The court did what I requested?
Yeah.
The court extended the protective placement.
Okay, and that's what you ultimately would recommend, right?
I recommended that, right. Correct.
Okay. So your grievance here is that there was no hearing.
My grievance is there was no hearing under what I believe to be a requirement of the Watts case. And further, there were no findings by the trial court under 5506 subsection 2.
Well, why was your client hurt when ultimately you agree that there should be extension of protective placement, and there was?
Well, because I think you have to separate the issues of whether or not she qualified for a protective placement with the manner in which that protective placement was extended. And I think you have... A question of whether or not there was a valid extension of the protective placement without a hearing, at least a summary hearing, and without the findings required by the statute.
So this hearing would be conducted out on the bench. This would be a hearing where the judge would come out, put on the record, and this is in the matter of Goldie H., and this is a summary hearing. This is, and I make the following findings, is that
correct?
Would other people be appearing at that hearing?
The hearing would be noticed out, and the guardian ad litem could appear. And
so you could come back again and say that I didn't mean what I said the first time, but or I have some amendments or something of that.
No, I don't think that's true. Well, I could say I have some amendments. I may have found out
correct.
Something
that's correct.
Since the recommendation that would change my recommendation.
Is this, having been a trial judge for a number of years, and I think that most, when you get these reports back, you go through them, you have a checklist, which was used, and most judges probably do not have a summary hearing where they go out on the bench. They perhaps do it in their chambers.
Well, I think that's one of the questions that this court has to address, because I think that is prevalent in the state, and I think this court has to address whether or not that's appropriate.
Well, why do you think it's not appropriate? Because now you got...
Well, I think it's not appropriate.
...on the bench, gives notice to you, gives notice to your client. Who else does the judge give notice to?
Well, there was no notice of the entry of the order.
I know, but who... How would you like to see this done?
I'd like to see it done in a manner where the court would give notice that there is going to be at least a summary hearing to make the findings required by the statute and required by Watts, and have that hearing on the record, the guardian ad litem present, and if possible, if healthy enough, the person involved, and corporate counsel, and have the court go through those grounds that are set forth in 5506 subsection 2.
You said healthy enough for the person. You mean that Goldie H. would be brought to this hearing?
Well, I think it's my understanding she has to be there unless there's some reason that she's unhealthy enough not to be there.
So looking at not just this case, but I was thinking, well, you probably, I don't know how many people you have in the state, and I understand the rights that are involved, but the protections are that you appoint both a guardian, you have a guardian ad litem, you get the report, and what you're saying, to further extend that there would actually be a, you call it a summary hearing, but you're envisioning that people similar to your client would be allowed and perhaps encouraged, or you would want that person to come to the hearing so that the judge could actually, what, view the person?
I don't know if it's encouraged or a matter of viewing. It seems to me the law requires that person to be at a hearing unless they are physically unable to be there.
Doesn't the judge have the discretion whether or not he or she wants to hold that hearing?
I don't think so.
You don't read that.
Well, as I've argued in my brief, I think Watts makes it clear the judge has the discretion of whether there's going to be a full due process hearing.
Or a summary hearing.
Or a summary hearing.
Or no hearing.
No, I don't go that far. I believe that the court only has discretion as to what kind of hearing it's going to have. It does not have the discretion to sit in chambers and read reports and sign an order without a hearing under Watts.
Okay. Mr.
Chairman. Under the statute, perhaps, you know, you could have an order fashion that would make the factual findings that are required by subsection 2 of the statute. And not have the hearing, but I think Watts requires the hearing.
Well, what I guess I'm thinking, and Gold, your client probably represents a great bulk of people, some who would, I was thinking of people who are in a vegetative state. You're not, and I understand this, but you would not be requiring those people. That would be something that would be up to you. As the guardian ad litem, whether or not they would appear, and the costs and the transportation of these individuals, would that be something this court should consider?
Well, I've been at this for a while. It used to be that people never appeared at these hearings, and I think the statute was amended to require them to appear unless the guardian ad litem certified that they were unable to do so. And I guess it's my judgment that's involved here in interviewing the person as to how vegetative they are, you know, and whether or not they are in some kind of a semi-conscious state where they really don't know what's going on, and, and would not have any purpose in being there, but that's not the case in this particular matter.
So that discretion, not just looking at this case, would be up to the guardian ad litem to decide whether or not his or her client would be at this summary hearing.
Yeah, I think that's what the statute says.
Mr. Joyce, your recommendation here, as I understand it, was to continue the protective placement. Is that correct?
That's correct.
How was your client injured in this situation by the lack of a hearing, be it a full-fledged hearing, a due process hearing, or a summary hearing? How was your client injured by that lack of hearing?
Well, I think initially she was injured because the findings required by the statute weren't made. They aren't made in the first order. They aren't made in the second order. Nowhere did the trial court judge say that she had a disability and why she had the disability and that it was permanent or likely to be permanent. None of those findings were ever made. So I think that's injury to her because I think that's an invalid order. It's an invalid extension of the order.
Do you think that those findings are implicit in the order that's entered by the court that basically says, I'm going to continue the protective placement?
I don't believe so. If the statute says that under sub 1, to order a protective placement, the court must make those findings in 2.
Does the statute say, though, that with each annual review, the court has to make the same findings?
The statute doesn't distinguish. But I don't think it's ambiguous because the fact it doesn't distinguish, I think, means it applies to all orders. It says you cannot order a protective placement without making those findings. And I think that makes sense because I think that the circuit court needs to review these situations on an annual basis. The likelihood of permanent disability may change, and there may be a change in the environment, the restrictiveness of the environment, on the basis of that or other considerations under those four factors. So I think there needs to be consideration of those factors on an annual basis.
Judge Preston.
You were involved in the original placement?
Yes.
Was Goldie H. Preston at the original placement hearing?
Yes.
What statute are you citing that says that the ward has to be present at the summary hearing?
5506, sub 5 or 6 or 7, somewhere in there.
What happens if, while you're looking that up, what happens if the judge doesn't enter an order extending placement? Does it end?
I think what's clear that in protective placements you have to have an annual review. There has to be certain determination.
I have to stand in front of the microphone because you're being recorded as well as being amplified.
I think that Watts is clear that, you know, if there isn't an annual review in the sense that these determinations are made, that there has to, that there is no continuation of the protective placement.
Your position then is that every time it occurs, it's a new. Can you go back?
My position is every time it occurs, there has to be a review of the factors under 5506 subsection 2. Now, I don't know if that's new, but I think that has to be reviewed.
What's the difference, the way you have set it forth, between a summary hearing and a due process hearing? The way you set forth the summary hearing, you got to have notice, and I would assume the court would say to the guardian ad litem, you know, give notice to everybody. You have to notice, you have to have persons present, right?
Yes.
You have to have a GAL.
Yes.
Right. Sounds like due process to me. What would you add to it?
There's essentially no contest. There's no testimony.
Okay.
There's no objection to anything. The guardian ad litem has already made a recommendation. that this person is qualified for a protective placement based upon the evaluations and his or her investigation.
So would you say that you were here at the last case, right?
Pardon?
You were here during the argument on the last case?
Yes.
In the last case, at least the statute could be read to say that you've got to put on testimony, live witness, to make a case. Here you'd say, in summary, the difference is you don't have to put on any testimony. Just file the guardian ad litem report.
I don't think there needs to be testimony if the guardian ad litem is recommending a continuation of the protective placement. But I think that the court has to go on the record, assemblies of wooden probate or many other matters, and make some factual findings that correspond to those grounds.
Well, what would the, what's the matter with the court on the basis of reading all this material? That's what the court's going to do,
mm-hmm.
read the materials.
Mm-hmm.
So why can't the court read the materials in chambers after giving notice to everybody?
Mm-hmm.
And sign an order. Now, you don't like the order. The order says, Appendix 7 says, the court having reviewed the report of the GAL, that's okay, right?
Mm-hmm.
It is found that, A, no additional info is required, is requested. You don't have an objection on that. The appointment of counsel has not been requested. You don't have objection on that. A full due process hearing is not necessary. You don't object to that.
No, I don't.
Okay, then it says, this is after reviewing the report, it says, now therefore, based on a judicial review, it is ordered that the report is approved and the current protective placement is continued for 1 year. What you want in this order, I gather, is to say it is found that, and then the elements of why.
Well, not only the elements, but the facts in the report that correspond to the elements, the same as you do in a preliminary hearing where you find these are the elements of the crime, and I find these elements because these are the facts. And I think the court has to go through that exercise, or we don't know why the court's continuing this protective placement.
Well, they got your report, and your report has all these boxes marked, right?
Well, yeah. I guess I filed both the report and a letter.
And a letter, right.
Yeah.
And you've said all of that in there, and the court says he's reviewed it. So let me just ask you this. Suppose that you had that in this. The court reviewed the report. The court found the following facts. These satisfy the requirements of section blah, whatever the statute is. Therefore, based on judicial review, it is ordered that protective placements continue. Would that satisfy you, or do you want the court?
I want the findings in subsection 2 with facts to back them up.
But
I think that's what the statute says, and that's what
I'm saying. All right, I'll accept that, and I'll agree with you for the moment.
All right.
For the moment. Why does the judge have to take the bench?
Because in Watts it says he has to decide between a full due process hearing or a summary hearing. And I think except for Watts, if the order was crafted appropriately to include those subsection 2 findings, he could sign that order making those findings the same as you would in a probate matter, many other matters where orders are drawn for a court signature. But Watts seems to say there has to be a hearing, either the full due process or a summary hearing.
And hearing means something in court, giving people an opportunity to talk, rather than in chambers.
Well, it doesn't mean, in my view, a summary review.
I've
never heard of a summary review until this case, but
right.
It doesn't mean, in my view, a summary review.
All right. So what is it you want this court to do? You want the court to withdraw language from Watts? Or explain that we meant summary review, not summary hearing? Or do you want this court to stick to the guns of Watts and say summary hearing and get out on the bench?
I think summary hearing is appropriate, the last of the three alternatives, because you're depriving somebody of their fundamental right to liberty. Even though you've done it before on the trial court level, in this case where you have the initial order, you're doing it again every year. And I think if you're going to do that, you ought to have a hearing for due process purposes.
My feeling, counsel, when I read the briefs and thought about this case, was that you're really here for all people who are in protective placement, and that you are saying to the court that protective placement is a very important, drastic remedy, and that it should not be treated in a summary fashion, that the court ought to pay strict attention if it's going to put people for a year in protective placement once again.
I think it's drastic in the sense that you're depriving people of their fundamental liberty. It's important. Now, I'm not a crusader in the sense I'm here for everybody in the state of Wisconsin.
No, you represent her, but you really are here for everybody.
Well, I'm here maybe in that sense because after this occurred, I'm being told by the trial court on the record that this is somewhat prevalent throughout the state. And I'm being told by other attorneys that this is somewhat prevalent. So now, you know, I'm asking myself how widespread is this practice of just reading reports and signing orders in chambers.
Mm-hmm. It's okay to be a crusader.
I understand that.
Right.
But I didn't start off that way in this case.
But we're forcing you into the position.
Pardon?
But we may be forcing you into that position.
Well, maybe.
Okay, yes.
Mr. Joyce, do you take other guardian ad litem cases like this?
From time to time, yes, I do.
Have you ever participated in a summary hearing as opposed to a due process hearing?
Never.
So a summary hearing, in your opinion, is one that takes place on the bench, and we've gone over what you would prefer, what you think should be in it. What, in this case, in just looking at this case, where would your client end up? I mean, would she be in a better position after the review? If we remand this back and have a summary hearing, what will happen to your client?
My client would have a presumably a valid placement order. In my view, the present order is invalid, and she's now in protective placement under invalid order, so at least she'd have a valid order.
As a practical matter, though, the status quo would be maintained.
I'm sorry, Justice Sykes.
As a practical matter, though, the status quo would be maintained.
That's correct. She would not leave. I haven't filed a writ of habeas corpus, so she would not leave.
To follow up on Justice Prosser's question, when you said that the cases that you've previously been involved in, the Watts Review cases, you've never had a summary hearing, is that to say that they've all been contested reviews, so you've had a full due process, or they've been uncontested and handled as reviews instead of hearings in papers reviews?
Yeah, let me explain that. I was out of the guardian ad litem work for a while, then I came back in. All right. In the last several years, I've been acting again as a guardian ad litem. And in my previous experience, I've never had a case like this extended without a hearing. And I was quite surprised when I got this extension order and there was no hearing.
Okay, so you've been acting in a different role as appointed defense counsel for the...
Pardon?
You've been acting in a different role as appointed counsel for the ward, not the GAL. Or am I misunderstanding you?
I wasn't taking GAL appointments for a while, and then while I was out of acting as a GAL, this practice developed, and I wasn't aware of it.
All right.
So in this case, I was expecting to have a hearing, and I got an order ex parte.
Okay, and previously, you would have had a hearing before the judge.
Correct.
Full due process or summary?
Summary.
Summary. Okay, and again, what's the difference between, and the difference between due process and summary in your position is one is contested.
Well, it is that there's nothing in the report to raise any questions about whether there ought to be a protective placement. Then I think there's a summary hearing.
Okay. You don't have to appoint a counsel and stuff.
Who's a guardian ad litem, not an adverse counsel, but the county counsel, yes. You know, and by the way, that provision about appearance is in 5506, sub 6. The subject individual, attorney or guardian ad litem, shall have the right to present. Oh, no, that's not it. I'm sorry.
We'll find it.
Well, it's in there. I know it's in there.
So in that sense, it's at least slightly analogous to competency proceedings in criminal cases where we get the reports of the experts and then come back to court for a hearing, and it's either a full-blown evidentiary hearing if there's a challenge, and then we take testimony, or it's a summary hearing in which the judge makes his or her findings based on the reports.
Yeah.
In open court.
In open court.
Yeah, in open court on the record, so that... Well, I think that's what Watts says. I mean, that's my view. It may not be, you know, everybody's view, but I think that's what Watts requires, that hearing.
And it's your view, I gather, that that's good practice. If you were going to be in the legislature, you would do that. If you were a judge, you would do that because you think it's good protective.
I was a judge, and I did that.
And you think it's good protective practice.
I think it's good, very good practice to have that on the record and make those findings. If I'm not going to have an order to sign with the findings in, but under Watts, I think I got to have the hearing. But apparently, that's not everybody's view in the state.
But you, as counsel, in following up, you think your duties were all done? Your duties as guardian ad litem, once you filed your report?
No. In fact, what I do is, I gave the judge a letter with the elements in, and my recommendation, really, of the facts that fit under each element. And what I do is I go to court for this hearing, and as he makes these, I check them off. And if he misses one, I diplomatically say to the judge, Your Honor, did you want to address that element? You know, and the judges pick up on it and say yes, and they address that element. But my job isn't done filing the report.
Counsel, how does this come into play, if at all? I recall in a number of, as a trial court judge, in a number of Chapter 55 proceedings, that the guardian ad litem in an annual review may say, continue the placement, it remains the least restrictive environment, and, you know, met all the requirements. And you have a myriad of people that are subject to Chapter 55, some apparently like your client, some who are walking. You'll meet in a neighborhood that are walking the streets, that go to your church. I mean, there's a large spectrum of 55 people. What happens when the guardian ad litem does a report that says, continue, but the ward doesn't want that in an annual review?
Well, I'm not thinking the ward gets adversary counsel to represent the ward in that objection, because I have to do what I think is in the ward's best interest.
Mm-hmm. And would you advise the judge that the ward opposes this?
Oh, very definitely. I think I have an obligation to do that.
And suggest that adversary counsel be appointed?
I would advise that the ward objected. I think it's the court's discretion. Most courts, if a guardian ad litem says my client objects to this, most courts are going to appoint adversary counsel, and if they don't, I would recommend it to the court.
Where does this form come from?
Pardon?
This form order. I couldn't tell whether it was a commercial order or it was from the Records Management Committee or...
Which order, Judge? The November or March order?
Pardon me?
The November or March order.
Let's see. This is... it's the blank order in Mr. Lang's brief at Appendix 7. Order for Continued Protective Placement. I assume that was the order used here. Form GN 1104.
No, that order was not used in either case, to my knowledge.
Okay, well, what order was used?
Well, the orders were drafted, and they are in my appendix.
It was the November 99 order is exactly the same.
except that it talks about an unlocked unit. That's Appendix 1.
Well, they have added on the restrictive determination.
But otherwise
it's the same.
Yeah.
I don't know where the order came from.
Okay.
But it appears to be a form order.
It is a form order. I was just wondering whose form it was and whether it's used to...
Well, I presume it's approved by the state. It has a GN number on it, so...
Well, I'm going to ask Mr. Lang.
Thank you.
Well, if I could...
Mr. Joyce, you have a question from Justice Press.
This follows up. Appendix 7 of Mr. Lang's brief seems to be a form that is very similar to the form in Appendix 3 of your brief.
That's true.
And that seems to me a pre-printed form in your brief.
Well, it looks like a pre-printed form. Appendix 7 has a GN number on it, yes.
They just added the language about the unlocked unit.
Yes.
But otherwise, it seems to be...
But neither of the orders, in my view, meet the requirements of subsection 2.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Lang, you're Dunn County, you're from the Dunn County Office of Corporation Counsel.
Yes, Your Honor. And it pleases the court. My name is Nicholas P. Lang. I am the Assistant Corporation Counsel for Dunn County, and I'm representing Dunn County in this case. I guess I'll answer the Chief Justice's question right away. The form in my brief at Appendix 7 is the Judicial Council form that had been Forms Committee form. It's distributed to all of the probate offices as a form to be used. At one point in time, it was a discretionary use form. I believe that its use is mandatory at this time. The form that was actually used in this case is derivative of that. My office drafted a form and included some more factual detail than was included on the pre-printed form. I guess I'd like to first address the issue of whether or not a hearing on the record is required in each and every case. The county's position is that it is not. It's not required under Watts, nor is it required under the constitutional procedural due process. Watts established that all protective placements have to be reviewed by a judicial officer at least annually. That was lacking prior to the Watts decision. And to implement that review, there were some procedures that were set up, and I think they're fairly detailed. There are requirements on the part of the county to file this report. It's referred to or required by Section 55.06 sub 10. That's referred to in the Watts decision, so the Protective Services Agency files a report. And then the guardian ad litem has to be appointed. The guardian ad litem meets with the guardian, meets with the ward, discusses the nature of what's the proceeding that's going on, various rights, right to counsel, right to a hearing. And the guardian ad litem is also provided a copy of the Protective Services Agency or Human Services Social Workers report and conducts his or her own investigation, files a written report with the court along with recommendations. And the other category, and I've outlined this in my brief, there are rules for the circuit court to follow. And there are situations where the Watts decision says, the circuit court, you have to do this. There are situations where there has to be a full due process hearing. In one of the situations, in answer to a question by Justice Bradley, is if the protectively placed person objects, Watts says there has to be a full due process hearing. I suppose it could turn out that it's, you know, in additional proceedings that it's not, that it doesn't get that far, but the presumption is that it's going to be on track for a full due process hearing and that counsel would be appointed. And I would presume and trust that the circuit court would act in accordance with that. There are other situations where a full due process hearing are required as well. If the guardian ad litem, if the guardian ad litem's report indicates that the current placement is not the least restrictive or inappropriate, if the standards for protective placement are no longer, they no longer exist, the ward or the protectively placed person no longer meets those standards, or if the guardian or the guardian ad litem or the protectively placed person asks for a hearing, there has to be one.
Counsel, yes. I'm impressed. I have before me the judicial bench book, and you have listed every single item consistent with the bench book. The bench book lists this recommendation a la a Watts hearing, and you hit them bing, 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 bing. One of the things that bothers me in the bench book on what happens with a Watts hearing, it is just as you say that there's an annual review, A. B, the department or agency is to review the subject's status. C, guardian ad litem to be appointed. This is all that's required by Watts. D, on review of GAL report, court determines whether you, number one, whether you need additional information, number two, whether to appoint adversary counsel, and number three, whether to hold summary hearing or full due process hearing. Then underneath that are the four things that you just ticked off so well as to what when the court should have a full due process hearing. And then the bench book finally, in its Watts discussion, discusses what happens at a full due process hearing. There is nothing, however, in the bench book. That's not the law, but of course, it is relied upon by a lot of judges. There's nothing in the bench book which makes any reference to anything other pursuant to a Watts hearing than a summary hearing or a full due process hearing. Now, you didn't write the bench book, but I'm going to ask you a question that might nevertheless. Why do you think it's not in here if it's allowed to have the kind of hearing that you are advocating? Why do you think it's not even mentioned?
One explanation would be that Watts may have an ambiguity in it. Obviously, we're here before the Wisconsin Supreme Court talking about at least a couple of sentences in the Watts decision, and I think that corroborates the reasonableness of arguments on both sides. Watts says that once the reports are in, the guardian ad litem's reports are in, the circuit court should decide what to do next, and it lists appoint counsel, additional examinations, other information, which could be anything. And then it talks about a full due process hearing and a summary hearing. One argument would be that list is a limited list. It's exclusive, and the trial court has no discretion to decide to do anything other than what's in that list. And I don't think that argument is frivolous.
Well, let me take the other things that are listed. The third thing is whether to hold, I'm just referring to the bench book now, whether to hold a summary hearing or full due process hearing. You're advocating that maybe that's discretionary whether the court has to do either. Let me take number two on the list. It says after you get the guardian ad litem report, the court must appoint adversary counsel when guardian or subject requests attorney. Do you think there's discretion in that?
No.
Okay. Number one, on review of the guardian ad litem report, the court determines, number one, whether to order additional information from supervisory agency or independent evaluation. Is there any discretion on whether or not the court at least reviews that?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. So the only thing that you're saying the court can modify in your interpretation of Watts is the number three, whether to hold a hearing or full due process or summary.
No, well, I wouldn't characterize it exactly that way. I think when someone asks for an attorney, it's a very concise request that can be met with a very precise response. More information, more examinations are more nebulous. They're vague. Every case comes with its own facts. And it could be that there's a relative who wants to take the protectively placed person into his or her home. That could be more information. And I don't think the items in the list are limited. I think they're indicative of what the circuit court's authority is in trying to respond appropriately to various requests for due process procedures.
So in this case, because the report from your opposing counsel was that Goldie H. would remain where she is, there would be no, that would be a discretionary thing for the court to decide whether or not he would want something more. In other words, as I read this, that the court shall decide, one, whether to order additional information, two, whether to appoint defense counsel, and three, whether to hold a full due process hearing under 5506, and four, or a summary hearing, because you have a period and a comma. So he could, those are his, up to the judge, one way or the other.
Yeah, I think, Your Honor, that there is an argument that can be made that this is an exclusive list, and I think that goes back to why those are the only two review hearings, I guess, if you will, that are in the bench book. But I think due process permits the trial court, I think, the discretion of the trial court judge, I think, dovetails with due process. In this case, what we're talking about is a hearing, generally, we're talking about a hearing where nothing is going to happen except that all of the written information that everybody's already read and agreed upon is simply going to be reiterated in court. And it could be that Watts requires that. I think there's a reasonable argument that it doesn't, and that's the position of the county, and that's the argument that I've made in my brief. But due process is flexible, it has to be adaptable to the various situations that are where it's required. Deprivation of liberty itself isn't unconstitutional, only if that deprivation follows inadequate procedural safeguards. And so I think it's a county's position, and I think that due process allows the circuit court judge to exercise discretion in some cases, and I think certainly this case, where all of the evidence, all of the written, the documentary evidence that we have, all the indications from the guardian and the guardian ad litem and the recommendations of the guardian ad litem all overwhelmingly support continuation of the protective placement. In fact, I think in this case, I don't think the evidence is even equivocal. you could...
Well, but take another case.
Yes.
There are issues of people who, there might be some disagreement about whether they fall within protective placement or not, right?
Yes.
Okay. In the Guardian at Lightham falls on the side of that there should be protective placement, fills it all out. Now the judge in the privacy of the chambers, no notice to the ward, right?
Okay.
Signs all this off. Says terrific. Is that very good?
Well,
I mean, let's. I know lawyers don't like to lose particular cases, so just take it out of this case. I'm going to ask you what's good practice. You're going to advise this court as to what good practice is, or advise the trial court what's good practice. You think that it's good practice not to give notice to the ward? You think it's good practice to do it behind sealed doors? You think it's good practice to have this kind of form order?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's good practice to have notice, but there is notice in this case. While the guardian ad litem personally meets with the protectively placed person and his or her guardian and explains and goes through what the procedures that are pending in court are right now and what their rights are in conjunction with those procedures. It's not a case where the judge...
Suppose the guardian just doesn't do all that. Doesn't think that the person can understand it. Doesn't want to upset them.
Well, I think that
would
be...
Says, well, the judge is going to do it behind a sealed door. Judge isn't going to ask you.
I think that would be really unfortunate. I think there's no question a situation like that, there would be a serious dereliction of the guardian ad litem's ethical and legal responsibilities in a case like that. And frankly, if a judge was aware that that was happening and still approved the protective placement, I think the same would extend to the circuit court judge's conduct as well.
But does the Corporation Counsel object if notice is given to the ward?
No.
Counsel, are you aware... And in your experience where there are these summary hearings on reports of this nature, similar to this report, or when people are in a, quote, vegetative state, you would go through this summary hearing on the bench. Are you aware of any?
Never. In 6 years as the Assistant Corporation Counsel for Dunn County, I'm the attorney that deals with these practice before that where I did accept guardian ad litem appointments. I have never been involved in a summary proceeding. It's either been a situation where the court has reviewed all of the written information and continued the protective placement, or some heightened type of due process hearing was involved where adversary counsel was appointed, examinations were conducted. It could include the right to a jury trial.
In your county, and I'm just thinking about what impact, if we were to think about a summary hearing, there are literally thousands and thousands of people, you know, that are in different institutions under 55. I'm not speaking from necessarily experience, but I was trying to visualize if we're talking and we're going to require notice and read what's in opposing counsel's direction, which is not, I'm just thinking that there would have to be thousands of additional hearings, wouldn't there?
Yes.
I don't know how many Menominee done, that's not a large county, but what do you have, a couple hundred of these a year, or 100? What do you?
Oh, I was afraid you were going to ask me that question.
Well, just,
There are many. I know that.
Is it in the hundreds or is it in the
thousands?
Oh, no.
But in you?
In Dunn County?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Is it in the hundreds?
I would say in the hundreds, over 100.
Well, Mike, having been on the bench in a smaller county of about 20,000, as I recall, there were, and this is at least 9 years ago, there were probably 75 to 100 of these per year. Multiply that out, we would be talking about tens of thousands of summary hearings if the court were to accept this argument and require this in all cases. Is there any, do you have any thoughts about an intermediate position, or is it all or nothing here? We either have to say that one would be required, or in this case, nothing, no harm, no foul.
Well, I don't know if there's another intermediate position than the one that's out. There's already a really pretty good one in Watts, and that is to, on the one end, to have a full due process hearing or to have a summary hearing. It may be that the circuit court or a party to the proceeding, something needs to be done, but witnesses won't necessarily be sworn or physicians testifying. I think the intermediate position is already in Watts.
Could I ask this question? Did the judge in this case ever make findings of a fact on the four elements in subsection 2 of the statute, 5506?
Not in the written order.
And you drafted the order based on this uniform form or general form, is that right?
Yes,
Your Honor. That doesn't call for those finding facts.
No. We included a little more additional information relating to the issue of least restrictiveness and appropriate of the current placement, and then whether the placement would continue in a locked or unlocked unit.
And fees.
Yes.
If a person were in placement for 10 years and this procedure were still followed for 10 years, there would be no findings of fact on those elements of the statute. Isn't that right?
Well, there wouldn't be written findings of fact spelled out in the written order. If all of the orders continued to be just the way that this one was, that would be correct. But I've made argument in my brief. I think that it's not logical for the circuit court to continue protective placement without it first having concluded that protective placement, and implicitly the elements that make that up are met by the facts. At some point, we have to trust our judges to understand and apply the law. And I think it would be a better practice to have the facts listed. but I don't think the failure to have the facts in there makes the protective placement order defective to the point where Goldie H.'s status as a protectively placed person is jeopardized. And I've alluded to this in my brief, and I'd certainly concede that if that was such a fundamental problem, then this order is invalid. If it really has to be in there, then this order is invalid.
What are the rules applicable to annual reviews in Chapter 51 cases?
Well, it's a slightly different procedure. The 5142 board has to file a petition with the circuit court at least 3 weeks in advance of the expiration of the commitment period. The hearing is usually scheduled and adversary counsel is appointed. The practice in Dunn County, which is the only county that I've worked as an attorney for, is that it's presumed to be a bench trial. If the adversary counsel, after consulting with his or her client, requests that it be a jury, then it's scheduled as a jury trial. If it has to be continued to another time to accommodate that request, then it's then that's done. But there are formal court procedures, and there is a hearing.
For due process reasons, why is there any difference between 51 and 55 in terms of annual review? 51 annual review, but I'm not talking about statutory, I'm talking about due process. 51 annual review, as I understand it, requires a hearing. Whether it's a short trial, we line them up from 8 to 8:30, we have two or three of these quick hearings oftentimes as a trial court judge. But from a due process point of view, is there any distinction to be made between an annual review for 51 and an annual review for 55?
Well, at the outset, the statutes require, or the applicable law, require different evidentiary format to be advanced in reviewing the placement or reviewing the mental commitment. A mental commitment, there by statute, there is required to be an examination conducted. And so you already have a requirement that isn't present in guardianship and protective placement situation, that a request for an examination can be made, but it isn't mandatory. In a recommitment proceeding under Chapter 51, it is. And so you've already got a presumption that there's going to be a requirement that a medical doctor, a psychiatrist, or a psychologist testify as to the elements that are contained. And I think there is a difference. The statutes make it a little bit different. The applicable law makes it a little bit different. As it relates to due process, I think if the statutes in Chapter 51 were written differently and more similar to what we have in Chapter 55, it's hard to say. It's a difficult question to answer because Chapter 55 has different procedural requirements than Chapter
51. Statutory,
yes.
Procedural requirements,
yes.
But from a due process point of view.
Well, one of the elements of due process is that, or one of the considerations is the procedures that you have in place already and whether there's a risk of erroneous deprivation in light of the procedures that you have. In Chapter 55, the statutory procedures are more ill-defined, which brought about the Watts decision. In Chapter 51, they're more clearly defined. And so you're limited in looking at due process. You are, to some extent, bound by the statutes that lay out statutes or cases that lay out the procedures that you have to follow. In Chapter 51, the statutes lay out more methodical, more, I would say, courtroom-oriented form of review. In Chapter 55 in Watts, I really think that the circuit court retains some discretion and authority. The circuit court has to respond appropriately, but I don't think it's necessary in every case to have a hearing that's on the record.
This, other than both statutory and constitutional requirements, for me, this case has an administration of justice issue, which is what I think that Justice Wilcox is driving at. You got 100, let's just take 100. You can take 200, I don't care which one you take. You got 100 cases in a year in Dane County. Probably got thousands in Milwaukee, maybe in Dane County too, and Waukesha. And the question is, you know, how do you get through these? Now, they're important, but we've got a volume issue. And with these 100 cases, we also got hundreds of other cases, right?
Yes.
Okay. So how long does the judge spend in chambers signing this order? What would you say?
I would guess here.
If you were the judge, what would you have? What time would you have to spend?
I would have to spend enough time to review all of the written materials and consider them and make my own decision as to whether
probably
or not.
Probably go back to a statute which may or may not be cited in any of these materials.
Possibly, yes.
Right. So 15 minutes, a half hour, depending on how fast you read and digest, right? How long will it take to do it on the bench?
Well, doing it on the bench, I wouldn't anticipate that a summary hearing would have the judge reading the materials on the bench. So all of that would have been done already.
You've never seen a judge read anything on the bench?
Oh, no, I have, Your Honor.
Just checking.
But just as a practical matter, these reports are... They can be lengthy, and
it could be, but this one has 2 pages or three. No.
Well, the social worker's report, there's also information. I think historical information.
So now the judge has spent the same amount of time off the bench. Now we're on the bench. So we're going to how long you think the hearing is going to take? Judge has read all this material. Everybody is present, and there's no contest.
I think it could be as short a time as a few minutes.
So is it a big administrative problem?
Well, I don't think on a case-by-case basis it would be, but there are a lot of these protective placement cases in the state, and I think something that dovetails in with that, I don't know the statute either, but I do agree with Mr. Joyce the ward, the protectively placed person, is presumed to be able to attend. And I may be old-fashioned, but I think if I were a judge, I would even give great consideration to requiring that these summary hearings be held at the nursing facility if the ward weren't able to attend. And I think if you amplify that or if you multiply that throughout all of the counties in the state, I think it can add up to a fairly significant administrative burden on the circuit court system.
Counsel, what about the cost? Would you have guardian litem, Mr. Joyce, would be there and others? In other words, you have a hearing. This isn't just with the judge and the court reporter. Somebody else would be there. Wouldn't Mr. Joyce or other counsel be there at
this
hearing?
So yes.
Corporation counsel.
So we're in corporation counsel. So if we're talking as the chief is trying to present the example, we'd be talking about literally thousands of additional people being involved, and that would be an additional cost. I mean, someone who pays the guardian litem?
Yes, I see my time is
up. No, who pays the guardian litem?
You may have a question, counsel.
It could be the court, but there are circumstances where that cost would be borne by the protectively placed person as well.
If the person has assets, I assume.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Lang. Mr. Joyce?
Yes, Your Honor. I just wanted to point the court's attention to 5506, subsection 5, which says the incompetent or proposed incompetent is presumed able to attend the hearing unless, after a personal interview, the guardian ad litem certifies to the court that the person is unable to attend. And that's 5506, subsection 5, the last phrase in that subsection.
Well, what does that mean, unable to attend? Does that mean that you can bring them in with a couple of nurses from the nursing home helping escort them?
I usually look at the person to see how ambulatory they are, and if they're in a wheelchair and it's just a matter of lifting them in a van.
But isn't that discriminatory, whether you're in a wheelchair or whether you can walk on your own?
Well, if you'll let me finish, if they're severely incapacitated and they're in bed and they're not able to really know what's going on. I've had people peek at me from under a blanket when I give them their rights, and that's how mentally disturbed they are. And I wouldn't recommend that kind of person be brought into court.
But who makes that decision?
I do.
Okay. And you're here.
But I think I make it, you know, I tell the court why.
Who are you being paid by, Dunn County? I mean, I'm just wondering.
I'm paid normally by Dunn County unless the person involved has some money, and then the court may order that they pay.
So in these, if we're talking thousands of additional hearings, would most people be paid by the counties, then most of the guardian litems for this summary hearing?
Well, I think when you're talking about extensions, they would be, because most of these people are unfunded.
Yeah.
And they're on Social Security, and the court is reluctant to order that they make payment.
But the way you're reading Watts is that, and you're indicating to this court that really your recommendation would be one that you would expect the court to follow, and yet you would want a summary hearing where it seems to me there'd be substantial cost of transportation, corporation counsel, guardian ad litem, other costs, and we know that that would be multiplied by, I'm just speculating, if you think I'm wrong, several thousand times.
I think there's additional cost. There's no question about that. But the statute seems to require these findings, and your decision in Watts seems to require some kind of hearing.
Right. I understand.
And I guess if that's not to be the cost imposed on the system, then in my view there has to be some changes.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Joyce, is there any reference to the summary proceeding in the statute?
No, there isn't. There is no.
Then why do you conclude that the sentence in 5506(5) applies to a summary proceeding?
Well, I conclude that because I think that if there is a hearing in a case, the people that are involved have to be there. I didn't analyze this section. May I look at it? I guess it's because nothing says it isn't. There's nothing that says this does not apply to an extension hearing. So it'd be my assumption if you're going to court.
Well, you hear members of the court multiplying the hearing that you're asking for by thousands.
Yes.
And what I hear you arguing is the presumption is that the ward is going to be present at all of those hearings. I mean, you're digging a hole for yourself, I think.
Well, I don't think there's an assumption that the ward is going to be present at all of those hearings. Now, some of these people are severely disturbed.
Well, that's what the statute says.
And I would certify they weren't able to attend in a, you know, in a number of instances. So it isn't a foregone conclusion that there are going to be thousands of people going to court.
What, why is that?
Because a lot of these people, at least in my view, are so severely disturbed that they don't belong in court for an extension hearing.
But we're not talking about mentally disturbed. We're talking about physical impairments. We're talking about other concerns you have. But as I'm looking at this, forgetting about whether you at least have two people there, that would be yourself and corporation counsel.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the ward, so to speak.
People, it may be the ward.
But similar to Golden Gate.
What's the cost if we make mistakes?
Pardon?
What's the cost if we make mistakes?
If this court makes mistakes?
Or the trial court makes a mistake and puts somebody under protective custody when they shouldn't have been protective placement. What's the cost?
The cost is that somebody remains in protective placement or in a particular environment that may not or should not be there.
Any other questions? Hearing none. This concludes the hearing on 00-1137, matter of the guardianship and protective placement of Goldie H. County of Dunn versus Goldie H.